So I've structured my talk today really to be more of a part two from this morning's lecture. And there's there's two good reasons for that. First of all, most of you have already seen what Chuck talked about this morning. But secondly, I've had the experience every time I've talked about this work so far, when I talk about the AFM experiments that Chuck and his group have done, people are so interested and have so many questions about those experiments that I usually end up having about 5 minutes left at the end of my talk to talk about what I've been interested in here, and doing some mechanics simulations to try to make some sense out of the experiments that have been done on CCMB. I've been working with Chuck, collaborating on this project for, I guess, maybe a year and a half or so at this point. And the calculations that we've been doing in engineering have mostly been Melissa Gibbons, who's a graduate student of mine, and then some of the later stuff that I'm going to tell you about, I actually have been working on myself, which makes me very excited that people told me that when you become a professor, you have to be a manager, and I'm finding that I'm still able to get some work done on my own, which is encouraging. So at any rate, let me remind you of what Chuck talked about this morning. These are the two most important force deformation curves, or the two probably most important, most interesting figures from this morning. And it shows that at two different pH levels, we have force deflection for a CCMV virus, which at least for a good distance is linear, spot on linear. For pH 5, it goes straight up, a straight line linear, and then it reaches a point, a certain critical deflection at which there's some sort of damage that occurs. And then at pH 6, we see also the linear regime here. But interestingly, the slope of this is less than the pH 5 case. So we know that pH 6 is a softer capsid. And the linear regime for pH 6 is much broader than it is for pH 5. So pH 5 capsid can be considered a stiff but brittle capsid, at least in engineering language, that's the way I would describe it. And then at pH 6 is a flexible, more flexible, but more, I hesitate to use the word, but ductile in a way. It's not truthfully ductile because you can see from the traces up and down that there's very little hysteresis, that this is really a very elastic process here, a reversible process. So when I first saw these two curves in a group meeting for Chuck's group, I was blown away for two reasons. First of all, one reason that I want to point out here, the fact that the deformations here are as large as they are, and you get elastic behavior, reproducible curve like this. So we're talking about a deformation of the capsid, which is 20 nanometers. So obviously Chuck told us earlier about how the capsid is smashed flat and that it recovers. That is pretty remarkable. And for someone who's familiar with more macroscopic engineering materials, there's nothing like that in the engineering world. The second thing that really was interesting to me is the fact that these curves are not only elastic, but they're linear for large deformations. So linearity we kind of get used to. Springs are always linear, and so many mechanical objects, have a force response which is linear, but that's usually the case when we have very small deformations. Linearized theories of elasticity predict linear force response. But the fact that we get very large deformations here and that it's linear is not trivial at all. It's very odd, and it's the last thing I would have expected here. So when I first saw this, I got very excited because one of my favorite things to do is to study nonlinear mechanics problems. And so I said, oh, this is something we've got to take a look at. The other thing that I want to point out, this indication of failure here looks exactly like a classic buckling instability. And I've taught classes that have discussed these sorts of things, and it looks very much like structural instability associated with snap through of an arch, or also it's somewhat similar to what you see in thin shell structures. And the fact that there's a rollover here suggests that it's more like the snap through of an arch. It's not really a first order transition, but it's something that happens smoothly. But it definitely is the signature of a buckling sort of event. And that's not to say that that's exactly what's happening here, but that was the first thing that occurred to me when I saw that failure. So in a sense, our mechanical simulations have all been motivated by the desire to test out or to try to come up with a way to understand these features that I've described here, and secretly with the hope that nonlinear elasticity would be able to explain a lot of it. And that's not necessarily...
Buckling position, how reproducible is the position of it?
The critical displacement, fairly reproducible, yeah. Chuck would be able to answer that better than me.
There's a range of forces, depends on the kind of I have to look if they're plus minus a tenth of something, maybe 2/10 of an atom. I've got the figures in that paper.
You used the term, I'm not an engineer by any stretch, you used the term, it's not a first order transition.
Okay. What I mean by that is that you would not expect to get bistability with an arch, for example, so a shallow arch. If you load it with a distributed load on the top, or say a point load in the center, at first it will deform and still kind of retain a single sine curvature, but eventually it'll reach a point where it gets an inflection point. And that process, for a given deflection, there is one value of force that corresponds to equilibrium.
What you mean by arch is just something that you don't mean something that's holding up against gravity. You just mean a thing which is
a structure that
is held shorter than the length it wants to be. So there's two different ways. So it will satisfy by either bending up this way or bending down that way is equally good.
Well, I'm thinking of a traditional arch like this. So say you have a structure, maybe it's made out of concrete or brick or something like that, and you put a load on it like this. At first, the structure will deform and more or less retain the same sine of curvature at every point. But there's a certain point at which it gets an inflection point here, and there's a point at which it actually loses stability, and you get very large deformations of the structure. So if you look at...
Is that what you call first order or second order?
This would be a second order transition, because if you look at the curve, the force, so this is the force versus deflection, say D, you end up with a curve that ends up looking like this. So at any value of displacement, there's exactly one force.
But for fixed value of force, there are several displacements. Mm-hmm. So typically for that picture, you assume you're putting a constant load, so then you can have several positions. So from that point of view, you have a...
Yeah, so it's okay, I guess that,
it's
so...
It's a constant of two different forces.
Yeah, so what I guess I mean to distinguish it from is a curve that looks like this. And there are such structures that have cusps like this in their force deformation curves. And thin shells tend to be that, those kinds of structures.
But that's sort of an artifact of having one dimension going to zero that produces a cusp?
One dimension going to zero.
Well, the width.
Yeah, for very thin structures, yeah. I mean, it's not in the limit of zero thickness. It's for finite thicknesses that you can still get this. Yeah.
I was going to say, if you take a tennis ball, for instance, and just squeeze it at two points, you notice that it will undergo a buckling transition, and the force actually drops.
Right.
So that looks like the first curve. So it has multi-valued in, you know, from one.
If you flipped it around, if you had a force-controlled experiment. Yeah. So, we should be careful about how we talk about these things. That's good
so
that you guys.
So the force, it would appear to be multi-valued.
Yes. Right. So this has that sort of characteristic look to it. What tells you that that's not all that's going on is the fact that when you unload it, it doesn't retrace that, or it doesn't say go down here and then as you continue unloading, snap back to this point. If buckling is going on here, in the real capsid, if buckling is playing a role, it can't be the only thing that's leading to failure, at least. I think that's fair to say.
But going back, it's basically separated. You don't even touch it anymore.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So then it's different.
So by the time you get up to here, the capsid must have undergone some irreversible damage.
It's squashed. It doesn't appear anymore.
Yeah, well, once you get up to here, definitely it's incompressible, so you've squashed it completely. So.
But it does not.
Yeah. Okay, so motivated by spending some time looking at these pictures, the major questions that I was curious about, so why is the force response linear to begin with, even for large deformations? Now, we would expect that for a shell structure, it's reasonable to have linear force response for small deformations. But it's not a trivial guess that it should be large. It should be linear for large deformations as well. And then these questions about what is really responsible for damage. And really embedded within that question, I'm hoping that nonlinear elasticity, reversible elasticity, buckling may have something to do with that. And then the other interesting thing that comes out of looking at those figures that we talked about earlier is why is it that the damage only occurs at lower pH? Okay, and I think that's something that, so what Chuck proposed earlier as our current idea for what produces this sort of physics, the dependence of Young's modulus on Foppel von Karman number or on pH, or the dependence on Foppel von Karman number on pH, this is something that could possibly pose an answer to these questions. So my hypothesis is, or my wishful thinking here is that nonlinear elasticity has something to do with this. So the strategy for testing that out is to use nonlinear elasticity. And that's not complete. That's not all of what I've been thinking about doing here. What I'm going to tell you about today is really these two things up here. So using continuum elasticity in three dimensions and in two dimensions as a way of coarse-graining the problem. I mean, the CCMV, if we wanted to do molecular dynamics, is obviously a very difficult system to study because there's quite a few atoms there. So if we want to throw away as many of the degrees of freedom as we can and still have a model that has the right physics, one approach is to turn it into a continuum. Another approach would be to try to bridge the gap between a continuum analysis and the atomistic analysis with multi-scale simulation. And I don't have much to say about that at this point, except that we have some ideas about how to do that. And if we have time at the end, I might say something about that.
Can you go to, I guess, full screen mode?
I can try. Is it not as big as it was before? Oh, yeah. Let me see if I can.
This is much better.
Yeah, that's much better, isn't it?
If you put the mirror displays box, see the surface.
Yeah, mirror display. That's
this is better. Maybe. Let's see. No. I'll try the mirror displays.
Mirror displays.
Where is it? Here. There we are.
That's a good picture. Use the physics on the screen.
Okay, let's see if that works. Sorry. Anyone else? What else can we do here?
Displays. What's the color LCD on the?
I can. That should be my screen here. I don't know why. Okay, that's better. Let's go with that. I don't know. Let's just go with this. So let's see, where were we? All right, so the strategy is we want to use continuum analysis or continuum mechanics to try to make some sense out of these experiments. So the what I would call the zeroth order continuum mechanics approach to this, to studying a spherical or icosahedral virus, is to look at it as a spherical shell. And there's two ways that one could think of modeling a spherical elastic shell. One is in the fully three-dimensional state, so thinking of the shell as really having two surfaces, an inner and an outer surface, which enclose some bulk material in between them. The other is to idealize the shell as a single surface, and then make some kinematic assumptions about how the shape or how deformation works across the thickness. And so that would be the two-dimensional approach. So it turns out that that it's, in its essence, three-dimensional continuum mechanics is actually a little bit easier to handle numerically. And so our first approach was to think of this as a thick shell. The other justification for thinking of CCMV as a thick shell is that physically the average thickness of the CCMV shell is actually not very small in comparison to its radius. We talked about that earlier this morning. But so if the average radius is somewhere around 14 nanometers, and the nominal physical thickness is around 3.5 nanometers, that's that thickness is a reasonable proportion of the radius. So,
except how well connected is it on that thick, you know, over that thickness? In other words, if you have thick elements which are just connected by some thin bond on the inside, then I would say a thinner shell. Mm-hmm.
That was something that I considered at first, because taking the maximum dimensions here, so say the maximum thickness, using that as the effective mechanical thickness in your model, probably not the right thing. Yeah, it would be wrong. Yeah, and so here.
What is known in this case, though, about how if you were to slice through, mm-hmm. and we saw this a little bit earlier, how well connected are proteins.
Right. So there, from the structural data, we have minimum and maximum thicknesses. The minimum thickness is somewhere around 2 nanometers, I believe.
Oh, so most of that thickness.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
the way it's put together, where dimers come together, you actually are at the absolute thickest point. And it's got to be, I keep on wanting to say 7 nanometers thick.
Really?
The dimer interface is really, it's only connected by
two peptide strands.
Really?
So it's really very thin.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, basically the dimensions that we've used in trying to construct these models have been from the papers, or from the one paper from Jack Johnson's group. And in that, and also on the Viper website, they list these maximum, minimum, and average dimensions. So could be that, I don't know exactly how they calculate those, but maybe from the... yeah, but it may be that this minimum thickness parameter is not really even small enough to get at these weakest points in the capsid wall.
Where are the big points? Are the 2 millimeter point?
I'm getting that number off the top of my head, but things built in dimers. In the dimer interface, you have a peptide. The C terminus from each monomer crosses over like that and is locked by the N-terminus of the subunit that it's going into. So that's the only interaction. On the other hand, dimers are purely stable solution.
And so dimers are strong, and you have just one link. How many links are there between the two dimers?
The dimer-dimer interaction is a whole series of beta barrel bearings
just
on the surface. So there's a lot of buried surface, and that's what makes those big curves that pop out at the 5 volts across the 6 volts. So,
I would say that this is actually one of the things that's made me the most uncomfortable about the three-dimensional modeling, is knowing exactly what to use as a thickness. It's a little bit arbitrary. And for that reason, and mostly because the connection between physical thickness of the shell and effective mechanical thickness, when you're coarsening your description to be that of a homogeneous shell, there's not a clear way to connect physical and effective mechanical. So it's almost like you have to treat that as a parameter that you can fit to begin with. And that's essentially what we did here. We had some idea, like we started out, we said, all right, there's minimum and maximum, let's take 2.8 nanometers, it's kind of in between, so let's just see what we get, what sort of answers we get for Young's modulus if we use that thickness. But in general, it's a problem when you're doing coarse-grain modeling like this. It ends up being a fitting parameter. So
we have two fitting parameters, you have Young's modulus and a thickness. And so
yeah,
if you change
that's
the
right.
One, you can change them.
That's so right.
Give us a feeling of the range. If you change thickness, and the maximum, how big the Young's modulus is.
Ask me again in another slide. So just to pay homage to the continuum mechanics here, since we have large deformations, I didn't want to skimp on any of the details. That means taking nonlinear terms in the strain tensor, for example. So this is the nonlinear part of the green strain. Usually for linearized continuum mechanics, we just throw this away and come up with a strain tensor which is linearly related to the displacement gradient. The other nonlinear terms that we wanted to take into account here, work of external forces, we wanted to model the geometry of contact between the capsid and the tip with some level of accuracy or realism. And that means that having a force which is applied the relationship between force and displacement is going to involve extra nonlinearities because of the contact constraints, and that you have these extra inequalities associated with contact. So this term is a large source of nonlinearity because you can open up gaps between the tip and the capsid. The other source of nonlinearity which we thought important to include is possible nonlinear relationships between stress and strain. So in general, we adopted a framework of hyperelasticity, which allows you to specify that the material is going to behave elastically or reversibly, but not necessarily in a linear fashion. Okay. Now, with that said,
so what
yeah.
dependencies include? Are you going to show us this sigma vibes?
Yes, I'll show you some models. So in general, in hyperelasticity, you specify a strain energy density, and the stress becomes a derivative of that with respect to the strain. And when you're dealing with nonlinear continuum mechanics, this isn't exactly the Cauchy stress that most of us are familiar with. It's a second Piola-Kirchhoff stress tensor, but those are not terribly important details. Okay, so when you include all of these extra nonlinearities, you get a problem that you can't solve by hand. Okay, and that means you have to choose some sort of numerical strategy for solving the problem. And the numerical method, which is most commonly used for solid mechanics in the engineering world, is what's called the finite element method. And basically, the idea is that you partition a solid, so like the capsid here, this is one quarter of the capsid, you partition that into many small, regular polyhedral shapes. Over each of those polyhedral shapes, you make a kinematic assumption. You say that the displacement field over one of my polyhedral shapes is going to be interpolated between the displacements at the corners of that shape. So if I have a brick element, like in this picture here, this is an assembly of brick elements. Within that element, there's a displacement value at every position, but that's related to the displacements at the corners of the brick. And it's related in terms of some known polynomial, simple low-order polynomial functions. At the end of the day, what you end up with is a discrete problem where you minimize your mechanical energy with respect to the motions of all of the vertices in the mesh. And that makes it akin to the Ritz method. So if for physicists who have done energy minimization using Ritz methods, this is really no different from that, except that the basis functions for the Ritz method are local in nature. So it allows you to deal with complex geometries very well. So this is the movie that Chuck showed earlier. I'll tell you what I can do. I can make it go as slow or as fast as you want. So where do you want to stop?
Are you going to tell us anything more about the specifics?
Yes.
By the way, it doesn't look very spherical, but I guess is that entirely just due to the quarter?
It's a quarter.
Yeah.
It's a quarter. Yeah.
Still, it looks slightly okay.
It's perspective. It's the perspective on this is a little odd. And this is a very coarse rendering of the actual tip.
I have a lot of questions on
this. Okay.
How many elements do you have things broken into?
Let me see if it says on here. I don't know for sure, but I can tell you that it's on the order of a thousand or so.
So what happens? The real important question is what happens if you decrease the number of elements dramatically?
Sure, you get bad answers. You get things that are not accurate.
You get things that are different, but why are they not accurate?
So if you have too few elements in here, you can think about it a number of different ways. But if in the Ritz framework, the fewer elements you have, the fewer degrees of freedom you have. The original mathematical problem is an infinite dimensional minimization problem. And so you're doing minimization over a constrained subspace. And if you don't have enough degrees of freedom, you can't get very close to the true minimum. And the more degrees of freedom you have, the better a chance you have at getting to the energy minimum.
But is your real question the fact that the real accounts are this finite number of elements?
Yes.
And therefore,
then
that leads to the whole assumption of
he's doing a better job of solving the problem he's trying to solve.
Right.
That's a fair statement.
And that's but my problem, the mathematical problem I posed, may not be a very good approximation of the truth, the reality.
It's just if you could limit yourself to 180 elements, that being a number that just pops into my mind for some reason, it might give you, where the elements is the whole thickness of the capsid, it may give you a view of what could happen in a generic capsid. Not a CMP capsid, but a generic capsid.
And then you will immediately stand up and say that for some reason, it pops to your mind that these elements should interact in a particular way.
Yeah.
And then it's not a better model.
Yeah.
I think it's reasonable to do honest simulation of honest continuum mechanics in
You're right. The trade-off is that if you use fewer elements, you have to start endowing those elements with more rich physics. So this is we started with simple physics, and that's where we're going.
I have another question.
Yeah.
We know that if we try to triangulate something on the sphere, there are deep topological difficulties in doing that.
Right.
And how do we tackle this problem?
Triangulating something on a sphere. So
what's your mesh? Is it a?
I don't know if you guys can make out. These are our brick elements here. So each of these elements. These are three-dimensional volume elements.
Yeah, I understand.
And so it's not a triangulation. It's actually on each surface there's a quadrilateral mesh, and that mesh is extruded through the thickness, so that you get hexahedra. So it's not actually triangulated at all.
Is locally rectangular parallel pipeds?
Yes, that's right.
When you say that it's brick, but they're not alternated in. I can't see.
Right. You have a bunch of elements
It's just a bunch of planes running this way, planes running that way, planes running the third way, and you slice up space.
Yes, that's right. You have a ton of elements that look like this, a cube, topologically a cube, but
the network of finite elements doesn't have any singularity.
No, it doesn't. That's right. How do you fit them all together?
Well, there's certain points where the different submeshes don't mesh.
If you use spherical coordinates, what happens at the North Pole?
Where is it? Right. So in this case,
you can sort of make out two singularities there.
There are singularities only in the sense that you have junctions where you have. Yeah. So let's see what is it exactly here. Yeah. You have. You have situations like this. Okay.
And so you.
This is really.
Right.
And you move. Well, it isn't potentially, but you move the disclinations off away from the contact point and the surface.
Sure, but the disclinations. I want to be careful here. These don't have any real mechanical significance.
Yeah,
this is.
They have numerical significance.
Yes, but no, that's not going to be true. In fact, it's difficult for me to try and prove it to you.
It shouldn't be a problem. Normally, there's some maximum strain angle.
Exactly.
There's well-defined criteria for estimating error, but I'm sort of confused. Normally, people don't use. Rectangular grids in 3D. They prefer tetrahedral grids. Are you using linear elements, quadratic elements?
We've done it with both linear and quadratic. Quadratic gives a little bit better convergence, but
because when you do quadratic and you do contact algorithms, typically you get instabilities. So that's
So this is using a commercial finite element package, Abacus, and they have.
Normally, only gives linear for contact, as far as I remember.
I think you can do both. I'm pretty sure because.
That's the version we have.
Oh, okay, possibly. Well, this
but
is
maybe.
We're
but
yeah.
But
at any rate, most of these issues are common, are very common, very frequently and commonly dealt with, I would say. The thing that I want to get you away from thinking about this issue, this thing being a disclination, is that what you're looking at right here is the reference state of this mesh. So this means it's undeformed. There's zero stress in here by definition. Okay, so if you start to move these points around, then you generate stress. But I'm not sure.
Do you define your mesh under stress as well? Is mesh adjustable?
Or the topology of the mesh is fixed.
So then, as you load it, doesn't it load uniformly?
Does the
as you start loading?
Yeah, it does deform. I mean, you can see.
Do you get more stress?
The mesh is not deforming. You fix mesh coordinates and you map the displacements.
Right. So you can think about this mesh. Wow. If you could only have sat in my course last quarter, this would all make much more sense. Not likely. So the mesh, you can think of this, it may be best to think of this brick, assume it's a cube, set up a set of curvilinear coordinates for that cube. They can be mutually orthogonal if it's a perfect cube. Then you set up interpolation not only of the displacement field itself, but also of the position field, based on the positions, the physical positions of these nodes and the physical displacements of all of those nodes. That allows you to have meshes which have odd shapes like this. And it, in the end, allows you to get around these issues of singularities at points. I'm not sure if that's an adequate description of things.
You can see as you compress, in fact, the stress is not located at the
That maybe the proof is in the pudding, that as I squeeze this down, if you squint at least, you can see that the contours are pretty well rounded around there. So
mathematically,
there
is a physical issue here in this.
Okay.
What are you assuming about tangential forces? You're just taking the normal forces by a constraint where they're interpenetrating.
Right.
And the tangential forces, no friction?
No sliding friction, yeah. It's completely slick tangentially.
Between tubes?
Between
the flat plane on the bottom and the sphere.
Yeah, between these two. That's right.
Well,
that's
right. Adhesion and friction are completely unrelated things, okay?
Right.
No static friction.
There's no static friction. There's no tangential interaction between the surface of the tip and the surface of the capstan.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I'm trying to put together what we heard this morning with this here. So that spectrum on the left is kind of a measure of energy density.
It's a scalar measure of stress.
Okay, so if there were two flat guys and you were squashing them in between, you'd get quite a different picture, right? The bottom would look more like the top.
It would be symmetric.
Good idea, yeah. Right, because you don't know from down. Right, so exactly the point. Now, where is most of the energy? Is it depending on what you've assumed about the tip? Is this thing dominated by what you've assumed about the tip?
About the size of the tip?
All that color stuff seems to go up there. Yeah. Size, radius, I don't know what you want to call it, how it happens to sit there.
Yeah.
Is most of your energy just there where you're making the biggest assumption?
I would say it depends where in the time history, or where in the deformation history you ask.
Oh, it is.
So at this point right here, obviously, the energy is localized here.
Right.
Yeah. So the tip, size of the tip has a great deal to do with that snapshot in time.
Other times ignored. Is this a tip-dependent translation all the way through?
Yes, it is.
In which case, since you don't know the details of the tip that much in an experiment.
Right. So how do you resolve this? What do you do about it?
Yeah.
Well, you do a parametric study. You study several different tip sizes, and then you take some measure of, or you compare the results of these using some measure. And in particular, we take the force deflection curve, and we compare those for different tip geometries. And we look to see how sensitive that result is to changes in tip geometry. And I'll show you that curve. And it turns out that it's not terribly sensitive. You see a little bit of difference in the slope, but qualitatively the shape of the curve is the same. I'll show you, hang on just a second, I'll show you.
Here, is that a significant
point of inflection in the
force versus
in layer. Here, yeah, right. So right about where the mouse, the point of inflection. So there's actually two points of inflection. So you go Hertzian to effectively linear, and then you roll over, and then eventually it starts going back up again. But for the most part, over here you have negative curvature.
Is it only going up when they start to touch again? Two sides? Is that how to read this?
Yes.
Normalized
yes.
Deflection?
So you're asking about this yeah. this point? That's this contact. Point occurs when contact happens okay. between the two plates or the two surfaces. Now, I think you were looking at this part right here.
Yeah.
So, right here?
No.
Oh, no. One nanonewton. Right about here.
Yeah.
Yeah. It turns out that at this deflection, that's almost exactly when the tip, the apex of the capsid separates from the AFM tip, right about there. I don't know if you can make it out, but there's a little gap that forms right here. That turns out to happen right about where the curvature of the slope of the force response changes.
And then there's some slip along the surface.
Yes.
The
yeah.
Surface.
Yeah, and that gap progressively opens.
But that's not observable experimentally, right?
It's not observable, yeah.
We don't get that if the capsid fails before.
Right.
You could be getting this in your...
It could be at the
You just can't resolve this.
Right.
It could be at the...
But there's no flexion. There's no change of curvature.
No, we don't see any.
Yeah.
You didn't tell us what is the stress-strain relation?
I know, I haven't yet.
So what's the point to discuss
yeah.
such
I know.
Fine details if we don't know what we're
saying? I wanted to woo you with pretty pictures to get you on board, but I'll talk about that shortly.
I thought we made a mistake.
You guys are too smart. Yeah, what's that?
Didn't you say it's not linear elasticity?
Yeah, well, this particular right. calculation is with a stress... a stress strain law that is linear.
Oh,
now, I will show you in a subsequent slide that doesn't turn out to matter much. Okay. Poisson ratio 0.4, but that turned out to be very insensitive too. Yeah.
And if you don't allow any slippage at all, if it's perfectly stick conditioned.
I haven't tried that. Yeah. I would. My guess is that it.
If you look at things like Hertzian contact and other things, it's not so sensitive.
Yeah.
But it might be by the time you go to this buckling instability, but that's not the experimentally
right.
relevant region.
The other thing is that the separation, at least at first, is so small that if there is any adhesion,
that would flatten it out.
Mm-hmm. That would likely keep this from rolling over. Because physically, I think that this separation here is a lot like the arch. It's, you know, in this sense it's amplified, or in this situation it's amplified, and you get not just a rollover of the force curve, but a rollover and a drop. Here it's much more subtle, but I think the physics is roughly the same.
To keep in mind is that the real world is not hard walls, right? And
yeah.
so if, as you probably do, you have some sort of compressibility in the outer part of the
mm-hmm.
shell that may be a little softer than
mm-hmm.
than the other. That will also soften out this buckling transition, and things don't suddenly leave. I mean, just even smearing the range of the repulsive interaction changes some of these details.
Yeah. So it Yeah, that's a good caveat to point out that, you know, we can't make too big a deal out of these subtle changes in slope, except to note that there is a tendency towards separation here, and that for certain parameters in the model, that might end up being more important than for others. Okay, so I promised you I would tell you about constitutive law. So the linear Hookean model is to say, isotropic Hookean elasticity, the stress is linearly proportional to strain. This is all the pictures or all of the video that I show is always this. But just to make sure, we tried rubber elasticity. And just to keep it as close to this as possible, well, not so much that, to avoid having to do incompressible elasticity, which is most rubber materials are effectively incompressible, volumetrically incompressible, we use a compressible neo-Hookean or rubber elastic model. And the thing that you always see in rubber elasticity models is this term over here, which involves the trace of the strain or of the Wright-Cauchy-Green deformation tensor, which is related to the strain tensor. But this is essentially the result that you get from doing the simple statistical mechanics on polymers. And so if you work that result out, you always expect to get an energy density which varies with the trace of that.
Just that, coming from the derivative of the entropy of random.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. The so this is essentially rubber elasticity here, or polymer elasticity, with some extra terms here to deal with volumetric changes that linearize in a way that's consistent with the Hookean behavior. And you can see, so this is the contact force versus displacement, and you can see that they're really hard to distinguish. I mean, up at larger displacements, you get some difference between the two curves, but at least qualitatively, they're not very different.
But if you actually look at this, the rubber elasticity tends to get really different from linear at very big strains.
Yes, it does.
If the strains are only 25% or whatever.
Right, you would expect.
You wouldn't expect any difference in it.
Right. But that's not this rubber elasticity without Munirivian terms, because there is a strain softening in rubbers at about 20%.
Right.
Which is not included here.
That's not included.
Right.
Which you're
going to
get
software
on that.
Right. So we haven't included that.
But that's not there in the entropic models either.
No.
Yeah.
That's the real rubber.
It's age dependent and also.
That's the real rubber.
So I mean, it might be worthwhile to consider other models, at this point we've already got a model which is probably different enough from the actual physics. So. All right, so given that there's not much difference between the rubber elasticity and linear Hookean model, let's just stick with this, because if you choose a Poisson ratio, kind of canonical value for that, say 0.3 or 0.4, then the Young's modulus is all you need to determine the other two constants, the Lemay constants. That means, yeah?
When you say that you've looked at a very different model, I think that we have to be careful, because the neo-Hookean rubber elasticity is also elastic unto much bigger strains than almost any other model you can come up with. And so if you were to just...
What do you mean linear elastic up to larger strains?
It looks linear. It's close to linear.
Fair.
Up to much bigger strains. If I just take any sort of atomistic potential, like Leonard Jones or whatever, at 6% things break, right?
Okay.
And so if you were to just use any other generic local atomic potential, it would look completely different, because it would go nonlinear at 6%. So you've chosen to compare to one of the few models that we know of that has a large range of nearly linear elastic behavior.
So this, you're saying this would not explain why things is linear, because you're putting linearity by hand. Because the real proteins, if you think about those bonds and alpha helices or something, you won't be able to stretch them by 10 or 20% before
things
begin to happen.
Okay.
But what it can do is check whether the results are robust to weak nonlinearities. which is a reasonable right. starting point.
Yeah, no problem with that.
It's just not realistically right. strongly not linear.
As the nearest thing to an authority figure here, I just want to say we've gone pretty much the better part of an hour.
We got to go faster, yeah.
And if there's something you'd really like us to...
Okay.
Might be a good idea.
Let's do that. So let me just point out. So it's probably, I have to be very careful about saying that I've used a nonlinear hyperelasticity here. That's fair. One thing that I think is interesting is that when you vary the thickness, you can get additional nonlinearity that has nothing to do with the choice of material model. Okay. That is interesting to me, and that's more or less what I was expecting to find to begin with. Even if you have a linear elastic stress strain law, that doesn't mean that you should have a linear force deflection curve, because there are many other nonlinearities that can pop into the problem. And it turns out that if you plot this force versus displacement in a scaled way, you can see that for different choices of thickness, you can get more or less nonlinearity. So, I mean, I'm not sure what to make of this, but it turns out that you get curves which are most linear for kind of intermediate values of thickness. I don't know. I don't think that's really a prediction, but it's interesting at least.
The dashed curve is the thin shell scaling,
it's just the line that I put in there by hand just to show, and in this case it actually is a line with slope 1 in the scaled plot here.
For all the shells plotted there, right?
The thin shell limit would be essentially this straight line, because force has to be linearly proportional to deflection.
Right, but the
coefficient for this. And that's dependent on geometry of the loading, principally. Whether you use a flat tip or a curved tip.
It's independent of the tip. Until you get to some buckling. It only depends on the true linear regime is completely independent of tip.
For a thin shell.
Exactly. It's interesting to compare that number with the numbers you get.
Let's hold on to that thought, because I think some of the other plots, if I get to them, we may want to talk about that again. So this is just pictures showing this separation, or what we called buckling. This is just so insensitivity to tip size. So we varied the tip size from 14 nanometers up and down by a factor of 2, and we actually tried a flat plate too. I don't have that curve in here. It's a little bit steeper than the others. But you can see that there is some variation. This is true force plotted versus... tip displacement. So that tells you...
It's independent at the beginning.
At the beginning, yes, right. But for larger... I mean, for even intermediate values of displacement, it starts to diverge. So...
But that initial slope, actually, there's a prefactor from the thin shell theory as well.
Okay.
But this is not the thin shell limit.
No, it's just there. This is the beginning of the answer to my question about tip slope.
Yeah.
Is the slope.
It's hurting content. So you're talking about here? Well, what I would say is that there's very little sensitivity to the tip size, at least.
Right.
So this scaling factor is pretty robust.
I'm just saying that there's a prefactor which could actually be compared with the simulation, so which would be interesting.
Okay.
So you actually quantitatively compare the thin shell theory to the
right. Okay.
As opposed to the scaling.
Yeah. Okay. So things we've observed from the 3D models. It gave us some reason to think that buckling may be involved here. The thickness affects linearity, but not very, very much. So more or less, the results are pretty insensitive to changes in dimensions. So thickness of the capsid, tip size, constitutive modeling. The largest strains are on the order of 15-25%. at the largest deformations seen in the experiments. Okay, so the big thing is we really have no way to explain failure from these models. So the next step forward is to think about trying to build into the model the icosahedral structure. Okay, so to take account of the fact that it's not a homogeneous shell, or it's not a shell with pure spherical geometry, that there's actually some smaller scale structure to it. And the easiest way to do that is using thin shell elasticity within the approach taken by Lidmar, Murney, and Nelson, where you think of the energy, mechanical energy of the capsid as a balance between bending energy and stretching energy. And so this stretching term is effectively the same as the linear elastic energy that we had in 3D. Now it's just specialized to the case of a surface. And then the bending energy allows you to... So treating the bending energy separately allows you to avoid thinking about physical thickness. Okay, in the 3D model, the thickness has the effect of adjusting the bending rigidity for a given Young's modulus. Here, we can adjust the bending and stretching moduli independently. And as you all know, the faceting of capsids or of icosahedral shells has been shown to depend on this dimensionless ratio of the stretching and bending moduli. And it turns out that these fivefold sites act as disclinations, essentially because for the stretching energy, the reference state of an icosahedral capsid is the icosahedron itself, the faceted icosahedron. But the zero energy state for bending is a sphere, or it's not zero energy, but it's the equilibrium state there. So to balance these out, you have to have some give and take between bending and stretching. And for different values of the Foppel von Karman number, this dimensionless ratio, you get more or less faceting. And so let me describe as quickly as I can the way that we do finite element calculations in this context. So to obtain the effect of these disclinations, we start out with a mesh which is truly icosahedral. Okay, in this reference state, so this is the reference state for the stretching energy. In the beginning, every triangle is as happy as a clam because it's exactly the size and shape it wants to be. But along the edges, in the true continuum limit, you have infinite bending energy along these creases. Now, with finite element approximation, it's not infinite, it's just very, very large. Okay, so in this case where the Foppel von Karman number is small, that means that bending energy is more important than stretching. So the initial reference state has a very high energy. So by minimizing energy, you end up with a state where the energy is distributed out over the entire capsid, and you don't have these creases. So essentially, this is the reference state that we start with in the finite element calculation, and then we minimize energy by adjusting the positions of all of the vertices in the mesh.
The grid is triangular?
This grid is triangular, you're right. And in fact, these are all generated from a true icosahedron, which has exactly 20 faces and 12 vertices, 12 fivefold vertices. And then to generate this mesh, we start chopping up each of the triangles into four. So you do it once, then you have a T equals 2 capsid. Is that right? I think so. 1, 2. No? T equals... T equals 3? Okay.
You start off with a facet of 3 subunits. That's T equal 1.
T equal 1.
Then you can divide each one of those subunits into three equivalent subunits. Otherwise, you start having...
Okay, all right. So we go through this process of subdividing the mesh until you get a fine enough mesh that we have enough degrees of freedom that we've essentially converged to the continuum limit in these calculations. So, yeah, so this has 2,562 vertices. So from that initial state down here, we can do this compression test. And I'm not going to take the time to go into the details here, except to point out that the mesh that you see in this case is not actually the computational surface. This is a detail having to do with the numerical scheme, but the actual surface is not piecewise flat. It's actually very smooth and turns out to be twice differentiable at every point. And that's important, actually three times differentiable at most points. And that turns out to be helpful for these calculations. And it has to do with some techniques used in computer animation. So what we find out is that the presence of these fivefold vertices facilitates buckling. It makes it easier to buckle than if the capsid did not have those fivefold sites, if it were just a sphere, more or less like the three-dimensional calculations that we did before.
Is that only if you apply the stress on
the fivefold site? No. And I'll show you more details about that. Yeah.
In fact, are these two different ones sitting?
These are two.
On the surface initially?
These are the same capsid. This side I've taken a cut through just so you can see the contour of the midsection.
Yeah, I was beginning to think one was sitting on its vertex and one was sitting on its
vertex. Yeah, I will show you differently oriented capsids. But the main point here is that if you orient it with the fivefold axis pointing along the direction of indentation, it's very easy to get these to buckle. And physically, I think it's worth pointing out that this is not terribly surprising because back to the Widmar, Murney, and Nelson paper, the whole reason for these being conically shaped up at the top was a buckling argument, right? They can't be flat, and so they either have to suffer a large stretching deformation or they have to pop out. So if you prevent them from popping outward by smashing down, then they're going to be very likely to pop inward. And so this is an inversion instability in a way. You're inverting this cone that has formed up at the top and the bottom. And so here's a pretty pictures movie. And depending on how carefully you do your numerics, you can get the top and the bottom to trigger at different times. Most of the time, I get them to go both at the same time.
That's just the different boundary conditions?
Yeah, if you play around with... actually, this is for two flat plates. But to carry out the calculation, you have to move one of the surfaces or both of the surfaces. If you move one of them, you can move one of them and just keep pushing it up like this.
It's not like it doesn't have any inertia.
No, but it has effective numerical inertia depending on how you solve the equations iteratively. So, yeah?
So when one buckles, there should be a big relaxation of stress.
Uh-huh.
So the other one will persist a little bit longer before it buckles.
Yeah.
And depending on how you, on moon phase, when you start your simulation,
uh-huh,
one will buckle or the other first, something like that.
Yeah, that's essentially right. So there's some voodoo that goes on with how you get the calculations to proceed, but that can be controlled very easily. Okay, so this is what I wanted to show you, the difference between icosahedral and spherical. And so this is the red curves up on the top here are for a very a higher Foppel von Karman number, so painful to stretch, easy to bend. And in this case, you see at first they track well together, but then the spherical one keeps going up in a linear fashion. And the icosahedral one with the fivefold disclinations rolls over. It's softer those disclinations act as imperfections, softening the structure, and allow it to go through a buckling transition at a much lower force than the spherical case.
With the same strength.
And that's interesting.
Doesn't this essentially answer the question I had earlier, what happens if you have fewer subunits? And
yeah, it's related to that, I suppose.
They're no longer homogeneous.
Yeah.
My whole point, it's not so much the number, but are they homogeneous? Are there interactions you need?
Yeah. So
all the pieces are the same.
Right. But you've broken the symmetry by putting these disclinations in there, and
but
maybe those are these.
Have the same elastic properties as every other piece.
True.
And everywhere it's a uniform sphere.
But their connectivity is different.
Those connected dots.
Spontaneous.
What kind of energies do those have compared to all the stuff you're doing here?
The point is the material itself is the same everywhere.
So what's the local.
To put in there, right?
To putting in those
imperfections, right?
It's very easy.
There's not an energy involved. They're red dots. I didn't know what that could be.
Those are the result of
on that scale. I'm only asking a simple question. On that scale of a graph.
How
much was the zero really?
Most of the energy is around zero.
Most of the energy is in those dots.
Yeah.
So always you kind of.
Let me go back.
Looking at this from a viewpoint of a kind of a strained system.
Yeah.
Strained focused.
Where you're looking at actually a very small perturbation on that strain
energy. That's the transition.
Yeah. I just was trying to get the idea what.
You're going
to
show that one, the orientation, how different.
I will. Yeah.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing to point out from this plot, though, is that for small Foppel von Karman number, which where bending dominates, icosahedral and spherical are nearly the same. And that's what we would expect because the icosahedral capsid adopts a very close to spherical configuration to begin with.
And incidentally, if you take the realistic, if you take the experimental numbers for the dimensions and put in uniform elasticity, you would estimate the gamma would be smaller than 100.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
I didn't understand. So.
It's not a demonstration. It says nothing about what the real system has, but it just says homogeneous elasticity is consistent with a much smaller gamma than those.
So you're going to explain why the stability occurs the same place in both models?
Because
of strain.
Why this happens here?
Yes.
Roughly. It's difficult to say. It has something to do with the fact that at this deflection, you have pushed the flat plate down on the structure to the point where what was originally conical is now a nice round or a nice flat region. Now, for the originally spherical one, you've produced something that's effectively the same. So you have two very flat sections which are about the same size, so
but
it's
the energy concentrations are different. Here you see all located on those few points in the spherical ones would be on the on the rim. So it was very different. I would expect factor of two is the difference and it seems that it's directly very close.
Yeah.
Because
I don't
stress concentration is very different than two models. If you draw the same pictures you have there but for the other one at the tip.
If you lifted it up by that, I'm saying if
you use the other model, the spherical model, and put these colors on a deformed position at this about where it's about to buckle, then you'll have a rim of red and a rim of yellow, of green, sorry. But it will be much lower stress, much more uniform distributed along the source.
I don't think so.
You will not have any special focus points.
But keep in mind, when you have a flat region here, the points where energy is focused are far away from that region to begin with. Well, yeah, they're around the rim.
Right, so it's very different than all.
I haven't worked out exactly a good explanation. That's a good thing to think about. let me just point out that if you do this for a series of Fabre-Van-Karman numbers, you can see that buckling occurs at different points, and this is scaled so that they all pretty much fall on the same line. You can see that for very small Fabre-Van-Karman numbers, eventually if you compress it enough, say to nearly flat, it will buckle. But that has more to do with the stability of a spherical shell without these disclinations than anything else. So you can then take the critical value of displacement and critical value of force where buckling occurs, plot that versus Fabre-Van-Karman number. And you get plots that look more or less like this. Well, no, you get these plots. So over the blue curve is the critical force as a function of Fabre-Van-Karman number. And you can see that more or less saturates at some point here. So the more and more conical it gets, the critical force becomes insensitive to what Fabre-Van-Karman number you have. The critical deflection continues to decrease just more slowly as you make stretching more important than bending.
So it saturates, or is it like keep going to zero?
This.
Does this mean the Russell number, or is it keep going to zero? Is it on a logarithmic scale, it would be.
I haven't. You know what? I'm not sure. I think that's a good point to make. I know that in the limit, if you have a cone, and you talk about this inversion instability with a cone, I think that you should have an inversion stability for. I don't know if it's for an infinitesimal force or if it's for a finite force, but that. Should be able to work that out.
So gamma big means it's easier and easier to bend, so therefore it's easier to bend. Is that?
Gamma large means, means it's harder, it's easier and easier to bend.
Yeah.
So it's harder, it's easier to buckle. Yeah. So harder to stretch means easier to buckle. Yes, you're right. Yeah. So this is what eventually led us to thinking, if we see buckling at one pH but not at another, maybe this Fabre-Van-Karman number has something to do with it. Okay, so influence of tip shape, again, we studied that. At least for smaller deformations, it doesn't tend to matter much, but it does change the location of the critical phenomena. Okay, so what I wanted to show you for sure is this orientation dependence. And this is really interesting. I have not gotten to the bottom of this yet by any stretch of the imagination. So you can load these guys on either the twofold axis, so an edge, or you can load it on a face, or you can load it on a fivefold vertex. What happens in these three situations? This is...
You can see
it
from the picture.
No, it's... You can't really tell.
Simulation.
Oh, this is, yeah, this is, I chose bacteriophage HK97 because it has a Fabre-Van-Karman number, which is what I chose here. So this is just to say it's kind of like this. The T number in the continuum case, it really doesn't matter at all. Okay, so what happens, so over here, this is a plot you have overlaid. Curves for fivefold, which is blue, threefold, which is green, and twofold, which is red. And the axis, I know that's terrible. You can see this is contact force versus change in height. So it's force versus deflection. And I've translated the curves here so that you can see something interesting that happens. The fivefold, which is the blue, and the threefold, which is the green, at a certain point line up and become the same curve. And when you look at the pictures, you realize what happens is if you compress the fivefold face, I didn't properly constrain this when I did the simulation. I didn't constrain out rotations. What happens when it buckles, it also rotates so that it's now in the fivefold orientation. So that tells you that this was the first sign I saw that the different orientations have different types of stability or different levels of stability at different indentations. And so I don't have enough.
Prevent that rotation?
Artificially in the simulation.
Right?
Yeah, but yeah, it's by essentially applying tangential forces. Yeah, and physically in the experiment, that might be done by some sort of friction or adhesion.
Well, very unlikely but to be observed on the tip.
Yeah.
My fault. This is the probability of having a capsule.
Well, that's not true.
In fact, with CCMV, they absorb in the random statistics.
Right.
So did you redo it? Not allowing rotation then?
So in fact, they absorb.
Yeah, I have redone. I've done the fivefold and the threefold disallowing rotation. In fact, for the fivefold, as makes sense, you have to disallow rotation at least at first to get it to compress, right? Because it's unstable sitting up on the tip. So I was doing that, but with the threefold, you know, lying on a face, I thought, well, it's on a face, it's stable. Why should I constrain it? And that turned out to give this interesting
what
result.
What turns?
What turns?
The physically the same
turns? The whole capsid turns. Let me show you a video. Let me show you this video. This is for I will replay it again, but you can see that as I go through the compression, it changes its orientation several times. So now it's on a five-fold site.
So the fact that in experiments, it seems to be buckling roughly the same place when your simulation is strongly depends on the face.
Uh-huh.
And if that absorbs on random on all faces.
Yeah.
But somehow there's a.
Yeah, we looked to see in the case of pH 6, where we can distinguish from. When we looked at the pH 5, where we can distinguish the different faces that's occurring, and we couldn't find any relationship between the buckling and the face. So this we don't see that.
So what it tells you that this thing is likely not happening with the virus.
Well, not happening. Well, as Bill says, here there's not constrained to rotate. In the experiment, it can't rotate properly.
But if you constrain this to rotate, we get significant different positions.
Yes,
that's right.
We don't see that.
You didn't see that. So there's I'm saying there's a little bit of a
problem. There is a discontinuity, a disagreement between that calculation will be observed.
So how far apart? How big of this dispersion you get in a transition if you just compare different orientations? Is it factor of two?
So this plot kind of shows you can get, I mean, just looking at the initial slopes, I mean, imagine shifting them so that they all have the same origin.
But is that first drop on the blue curve associated with a rotation? I mean, how do we distinguish when it rotated from when it rotated?
Yeah, well, in this case, I can tell you, the green one's the only one that involved any rotation. These two were constrained to the blue curve was constrained to be on a five-fold vertex. So these are associated with inversion. The red one here is the twofold edge, so it's lying on an edge. And in that case, this jump here is when two fivefold sites simultaneously invert because I've constrained out rotation to prevent that from happening. And for the threefold case, up to the point where it buckles, no rotation is experienced. So it stays on its face until hitting this point, face no longer is stable, it rotates around. So at least I can say before things buckle, if you have these three different orientations, if you look at the initial shape of the curves, they're very different.
In your simulation, the solar system is reflecting stress on individual.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, this is.
What's the difference in slopes about factor of three?
Yeah, between the smallest and the largest.
Some particular value of the gamma.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, we look to see if even the spring constants vary with the orientation. Can we try to see it as best as you can?
So there's some inconsistencies here that we have to resolve.
Small gamma. Do you see this washout?
I would guess that it will. Yeah, I haven't looked at it carefully yet. Actually, yeah, this calculation done here, I should have shown the force deflection curve. In this case, when these buckling events happen, it pretty much tracks along a very nice curve. It's just you get little blips and then it jumps back onto the curve. And so for smaller Pfaffel von Karman number, these differences between orientations shrink. Yeah.
That, together with the fact that you tend to see only one slope in the experiments, I'm biased, I guess, but if you just put in the numbers for the actual geometries of the viruses that have been studied with the AFM, they tend to be ones that you'd expect to have small gammas.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering how much this larger gamma analysis has to do with
either
CCMV or 529. That would be very interesting to take HK97.
Well, that's one of our things we want to study.
That you actually think should have a big gamma.
Yeah, well, we'd like to look at HK97.
Yeah, okay. But I'm sort of coming away with the idea that gamma probably is pretty small still.
For CCMV, that's a story that...
And 529.
Yeah.
And probably buckle as well.
Seriously,
much farther.
But they see a huge linear regime. That's the point.
So it's as if gamma is changing with pH.
Oh yes, does that mean it's going down with increasing pH?
Right.
Even more spherical.
To throw an idea at you, the stability of interactions changes pretty dramatically in that pH range as you. Lower your pH, you tend to get stronger interactions, but if those interactions are also less forgiving, you would have a greater chance of buckling. A strong but narrow range of a flex.
But one other thing, in Phi 29, there was this multiple failures, and there is a multiple failure.
Yeah, but they still had pretty large linear regimes.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that the fact that there was a sawtooth kind of behavior that seemed to have some sort of regularity.
But I don't think that was as regular as what you guys see with the CCMV. So, I mean, the point is.
But I'm talking about once it buckles, there was some comment made about having multiple.
Yeah, that's enough. We need to take a break or be done, yeah. I will say one last thing in response to what you were saying, Fred. This issue of wanting to have a low Pfaffel von Karman number and still have buckling, I think is problematic because you look at for the lower Pfaffel von Karman numbers, this plot shows you what the critical deflection has to be for a low FVK. So say take 200, being optimistic that it's as large as 200. You have to go all the way up here, which is over here, that tells you that the deflection has to be about 1.5 times the radius.
But that's surfaces.
Yeah,
this flat surfaces, right?
That's right.
So that number is brought down.
Right. Thin shells, I mean, a ping pong ball.
Yeah. Or, but those are very high Pfaffel von Karman number. A ping pong ball is a very high Pfaffel von Karman number because the thickness is so tiny. So
tennis ball.
Okay, yeah. We've got to end it.
Yeah.
But we'll
but that what you were just saying, I think it is crucial maybe that you have these tips that are comparable to the radius to see the buckling, and if you went it remains bigger than a nano inventor tip or one of the have you used colloidal particles or any of these other tricks?
Yeah, we haven't done anything.
Find the virus then.
A lot of the colloidal particles aren't as smooth as one would like, and they tend to be softer. But
easier to find the theory of it.
How big is HK97?
Hmm.
500 nanometers, 550 nanometers, so much.
Yeah, it's big. Yeah, it's about twice as much. So that has.
CCMP was
28.
HK97 is bigger as T. It's
a big, but it's also a bigger diameter part.
Yeah. And it's got the lux. Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you all for listening.